This is Geek Speak with Lyle Troxell, a show exploring the intersection of humanity and technology coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley.
This week on Geek Speak, John Barlow secures Verizon's Bitcoins. This week's episode is dedicated to John Perry Barlow, writer, lyricist, and internet freedom pioneer. And we also talk about wood that's stronger than steel. We also look into Google Chrome's move to label unsecure sites, Verizon's trouble with phone thefts, and speak in depth on cryptocurrencies. All this and more on this week's episode of Geek Speak.
Welcome to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air and with me is Mr. Miles Elam. Miles is a programmer, and well, you've heard the show before. You know who he is. He's awesome. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Pretty good. Let's talk about, let's talk about another internet pioneer who unfortunately has passed. But let's go ahead and dedicate the show to this person. Who is it?
Yes, we're dedicating this show to John Perry Barlow, who was the founder of the Electronic Freedom Foundation, among other things. His vision for the internet was always very much egalitarian, trying to give voice to the previously voiceless. Mm-hmm. He passed away quietly in his sleep on February 7th. And we will be missing him, and especially all of the past work, 27 years working at the Electronic Freedom Foundation.
Well, thank you very much, John Perry Barlow, for the EFF and for your dedication. I do want to hear about this crushed wood is stronger than steel. What, how, why, what's going on?
Well, first off, it's when we're building materials, having something in concrete is a very different experience or with steel than building with wood.
First off, concrete and steel are very different, okay?
Yes, they are. But they are both used in scenarios where wood just can't handle the problem. You use steel for very tall buildings, wood would crush under its own weight. Yeah. You use concrete to that has
You never use concrete without steel. Almost never, right? So, but yes, totally granted, these are different forms of material. Go on.
But I mean, I'm talking about for construction. And wood has a very specific niche, which is...
Right, and at one point, when you're a certain height and certain structure, you just can't use wood, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Okay.
People have been trying to make wood better. I mean, we've had pressure-treated wood for forever, something to make it so it doesn't rot, you know, things like that. But people have also been trying to make wood itself stronger.
By the way, I love that it's called pressure-treated wood, and we all know what that means. But, of course, if you really think about what that actually is, it's chemically treated wood that was treated by injecting chemicals under pressure.
Yes.
It's not like the pressure did anything except for push the chemicals deep into the wood.
Well, yeah.
But it's chemical treated wood. But go on.
Yeah. So what a group did, and this is from University of Maryland in College Park, the person in charge, Li Teng, took natural wood like oak, boiled it in a solution of sodium hydroxide and sodium sulfite for 7 hours.
All right. What does that produce?
It leaves the cellulose mostly intact, so the rigid structure, but it dissolves a fair amount of the lignin.
Which is the connecting tissues of the cells, yeah.
But not quite as
strong
rigid
as the cell itself, yeah.
And so it leaves more of that hollow space
that
you can fill in with other things. Actually, it really just leaves the hollow space. They don't try to get rid of all of the lignin, though. They found the sweet spot is getting rid of 45% of the lignin, because the lignin also, without any lignin, the whole thing becomes very brittle.
Mm-hmm.
You need something that acts as a connective tissue, if you will, to the wood. So they have a lot of this open space now. So then, at boiling temperature of water, 100 C, they compress it for a day, like a panini sandwich.
Okay.
Is how they refer to it.
Sounds delicious.
And so the plank ends up 1/5 the thickness.
Wait, are they doing this with, like, dimensional wood? I imagine when you talked about this, when they boiled it, this became a mush and like a pulp.
No.
It doesn't do that.
Yeah.
It pulls some of the gluing structure away, but leaves hollow spaces, more hollow spaces than wood.
Right. It's dimensional wood. It's not,
of course,
it's not as mush.
Oak is a pretty, is a hardwood. It's classified as a hardwood, and it's pretty dense. So if you pick up a piece of oak, it's going to be a lot heavier than something like redwood or pine.
Yeah.
Because it's already pretty dense. But they pull the material, some of that material out of it, chemically.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
And then they heat it up and squish it for a day, like a panini sandwich.
Right. So it ends up as 1/5 the thickness.
1/5 the thickness.
Right. But 3 times the density of natural wood.
That would make sense, sure.
And what they've come up with is something that is 11 and a half times stronger
than the original wood.
Than the original wood. Now, people have tried doing this before, and they get like 3 or 4 times stronger. This is 11.5, which puts it into the realm of what the density and strength of steel is.
That's really, really cool.
And from what they're describing, this is not as energy intensive as trying to smelt steel.
Wow. Of course, you've got to deal. You've got to have a factory to do this kind of thing.
Sure.
Are they going to go into production? Where is this research being done?
This is University of Maryland in College Park.
That'd be pretty cool. Speaking of steel, steel is awesome. But okay, go on.
It absolutely is. And it's not going away.
Right.
But wood can be very plentiful. It's a great carbon sink. Although I don't know how much gets petered away from the lignin going.
Yeah, steel is much less of a carbon sink. That's true.
That's
funny because steel is iron with carbon in it. That's what steel is.
So yes.
It's carbon sink. It's not really, though. It's a very small percentage.
But like what 2%. Is wood? Like, a lot of times people think of wood as being, you know, it grows from the ground, but it's not taking the carbon from the ground.
No.
It's gathering the CO2 from the air and turning it into a structure.
Yeah. That's something I remind my kids about, to the point where they're annoyed with me, that when you see a tree and it has no leaves on it, and then at the end of the year before fall, it's got leaves on it, all of that matter, effectively, almost all of it, not some of the water, obviously, came from the air. It's not like stuff traveled from the earth and went up into the tree up there. A little bit did.
It's coalesced air.
It's coalesced air. That's where leaves come from. All growth things.
Sunlight power. Sunlight and water powered coalesced air.
You want to blow yourself a mind, blow your mind away. What's the opposite of fire?
The lack of oxygen.
The opposite of fire is plant. Because if you think about it. When you burn something, most of the stuff that gets burned gets turned into, you know, straight carbon.
Well, oxidizing.
Yeah, oxidize it. It goes into the air, right? A plant actually takes that stuff out of the air and makes its structure with it. So plant growth and fire are opposites of each other. Pretty neat, right?
Sure.
I've got cool 12-year-olds, is what I'm saying.
It is reversing a process of, you know, O2 and, you know,
It's chemically, the balance is pretty close. Okay, that's really cool. I want to get this into production, but I have to say, there's going to be one problem with this. I've been an amateur woodworker all my life. Like, I've always loved woodworking. When I was, one of the first toys I remember getting was a set of wood carving tools, which I have never effectively really used and still have to this day, because tools, I never give up. In any case, I've loved working with wood. You know, I've built furniture for my kids and worked on sets, and I've done a lot of woodworking over there. I know how it works. I know how to use it. I know how to, you know, bound things together to make it work. I understand wood glue is importance and all that kind of crap. But in the last year, I've just started using steel and welding, and it's just like it's a completely different joy in that. If you make a mistake in it, you just add some more metal and grind it down. And it's like, mistake gone. You can't do that with wood. You got a problem with wood. You put wood putty in it. You failed. You've miserably failed. It's like, here, this is the part where I failed. But with steel, it's like, look how good that looks. Actually, I totally screwed up 4 times and then I made it work. Anyway, so when you have this really awesome oak that's, you know, steel in strength, you still can't bend it. You still can't weld it. You still have to use fasteners and glue. Of course, this stuff's so dense. How would you even? You're gonna have to do a lot of joinery with this because it won't bond with glue very easily because there won't be pores. Like, the denser the wood, it's really hard to glue really dense wood.
It would be interesting the fact that maybe you would want to make the joiner cuts before the compression. Like, that would be really
that's
I don't know.
Awesome. You do all this mill work on the wood to make all these shapes, and then you compress it down. You know, that does happen in mold making, because when you know any kind of plastic thing you've got, like not your cell phone, because your cell phone's probably all glass, I don't know, anything that's made of plastic, the dash of your car. Mm-hmm. Okay, that thing's this giant piece of plastic, right? And how they actually made that is there's a patterned thing that has like the faux leather look on one side, a big shell that's an inverse.
It's
of it,
a mold,
right?
Yeah.
That mold is actually slightly bigger than the size that it needs to be, because when it's done, it's hot, and when it cools down, it shrinks slightly. Mm-hmm. And so you actually get a little bit more detail out of it because the things get shrunken, so the detail gets smaller. But the thing that's amazing about that is that they're so good at doing that that when they're designing the system, they can make the mold and understand the shrink capabilities, and then it will fit perfectly, such that the screws work in it, like everything works in it. That is really neat. So yeah, I can imagine that if you got into process with this oak, it would totally be like that. You could, you know, do all your work and then shrink it.
Yeah. Well, in hindsight, I was thinking it's probably easier to compress first and then take something that's just a really heavy-duty cutter. And
yeah, yeah. Interesting.
I was watching a video, actually, where it was they took a piece of paper, and yeah. You spin it fast enough, and you can cut through a lot of stuff.
Sure, yeah, you can. So, yeah. You know, when I think of processed wood, the processed wood that we're most familiar with and have the most disdain for is particle board, compressed glued wood particles. And one of the things we happen to love very much is paper. I mean, a lot of us have... Do you have an attachment to paper? Do you like a good, thick-bound paper? I love paper. Especially around Valentine's. Paper is just fun to play with. Anyway, I absolutely love paper, and I absolutely hate particle board. And yet they're really the same thing, just different grain levels. But with particle board, you know, the whole industries have made with this really flimsy... It's like the worst excuse for wood, right? Sure, you can glue it, but the glue won't hold. It'll rip the glue will actually rip the material apart really easily. Yeah, you can use fasteners on it, but you better design them such a way that they don't put a lot of strain at one point, because it will fail. Mm-hmm. You can't get it wet at all. If you get it wet, the whole thing will sog and fall apart. All these qualities are not actually like really good wood, right? It's just the cheapest wood you possibly can make in bulk. So the idea that you'd have a processed wood, which would be like the highest quality wood you could get, like this is oak, but much better, is really neat. I like that idea.
Also, that reminds me, I remembered seeing some videos also about taking a piece of paper, fold it in half, fold it again.
You can't get above 7, but go on.
Until the point where you personally don't have the strength to fold it anymore. Then you put it into a press, a hydraulic press. And then you try to, you know, kind of wrench it over like with tools to get that extra thing, and you put the press on again, and you basically have wood again. Like you can, you know, tap on it, and it's like, this is all it. Feels like wood, it's wood again.
Yeah, cellulose is pretty cool stuff.
One of the issues that has come up with regard to iPhones, especially the recent iPhone 8 that was in the news, was that you have armed robberies, like people taking huge amounts of them, like hijacking trucks and making off with hundreds of these phones. And
we talked about people doing early purchasing and then the box showing up empty, that kind of thing.
Right. Or just the
box never shows up.
Yeah. Box never shows up. And this didn't happen with AT&T phones. AT&T, when you buy a phone through AT&T, they lock it down so that you can't use it with a different carrier, and the EMEA number is also like that. With regard to the Verizon phones, in general, they weren't locked. And so after they were stolen, they could be shipped off outside the U.S. and then bind to another carrier that had, you know, those signals. Although Verizon, like CDMA, that's the protocol it uses, which is different from AT&T and T-Mobile's GSM, and what most of the world uses is GSM. CDMA isn't used all that much outside the U.S. I believe there's a spot in Japan, but in general, they're not
useful in that regard.
Right. So that was kind of a way to sidestep that, except that the iPhones that support Verizon also support GSM.
Gotcha.
They kind of have to, because otherwise your phone is only ever useful in your country. If you cross a border into Canada, you're out of luck.
The phones have to have multiple antennas because of that ability for them to charge you lots of money when you travel.
The AT&T phones, however, cannot do Verizon. It doesn't go both ways. So
you want to get a Verizon phone, even if you're an AT&T customer.
But the armed robberies have caused enough of a dent.
Armed robberies? Because at first we're talking about stolen from the back of cars or back of trucks. Now you're talking about armed robberies.
Some of them are armed robberies.
So they're changing their policy?
They're changing their policy to lock phones and also looking to let customers, lock phones as well.
Prior to purchasing them?
Well, after they already have phones that aren't already locked. But
I thought that once you got your iPhone and you set it up with your Apple ID account and all that, what's it called? I thought that at that point your phone was basically locked and bricked if you tried to. You could reset it remotely in the whole deal.
Once you set it up with an iCloud account, you set it up with that Apple ID.
But before that case, it's vulnerable.
Right.
Interesting. Miles, please tell me your political story for today.
Well, I always love talking about Bitcoin.
Oh, okay. We're doing Bitcoin? I thought we were doing International Space Station.
Someone didn't hit refresh.
Oh, I see. Maybe I should make the website refresh automatically. Yeah, let's talk about Bitcoin. In a little while later, we will be talking about other things besides cryptocurrencies. We'll be talking about some politics and space. Go ahead. Tell me what's going on in Iceland.
It turns out that Bitcoin mining is on track to use more electricity than the residents of Iceland used for any other purpose than Bitcoin mining.
So the energy for Bitcoin or for cryptocurrency mining in Iceland is going to supersede all other use for electricity in Iceland?
Yes.
Yikes. Does Iceland have good, cheap electricity?
It does.
Are they nuclear or something?
No, they are geothermal.
Oh, they have a lot of energy.
Yes, they are non-polluting in general. Renewable energy,
one energy source that's like hands down, slam dunk, perfect, great. Let's use that.
they have active volcanoes near them in a very cold climate.
What more could you want? That's where you should move.
Very hot and very cold equals a lot of electricity.
If they have active volcanoes and they're taking advantage of them, I would claim that those are not carbon neutral. It's just that you can't control how much carbon they're putting out. It's just going to happen anyway. You might as well use it.
Is it really carbon? I thought it was more along the lines of particulates that are coming out. It's not always necessarily carbon.
Volcanoes definitely cause air pollution.
Yes, they do.
That's all I'm saying. It's not like they can control it. It's not their fault. They're taking advantage of that. But if you and I had a coal plant that we just couldn't control, just spitting out tons of crap into the air, it's like, well, we might as well use the free electricity. That's basically what they have.
It's not just the volcanoes that are erupting, because they can just dig in and you have hot spots.
Right, right. That's actually what you want. You want to be able to find a place where you get hot springs and just throw water.
Where lava's not going to spit in your face.
No, you don't want lava. Yeah, sure.
You want lava. You just want it insulated by a fair amount of rock.
You know, when I was traveling this last summer, we went to Yellowstone National Forest. And, of course, Yellowstone is, you know, famous for this giant volcano caldera. And at one point, the Earth will change drastically when it goes off. Hopefully not in our lifetimes or our children's. But when you're there and you're, like, traveling even outside of the area, when you visit a natural spring and you're like, wow, talk about an amazing location. Like, having just a natural heat source of water flowing through your village or whatever, you can't beat that. That is, like, the best place to be. Possible. Let's see. I can go ahead and, well, it's hot water and it's going to be compressed coming out of the air if you try to compress it. So you basically have free energy. Yep. And it's warm too and fun to sit in. Okay, go on.
Now, this kind of dovetails with, like, you have this economy that's based upon, you know, you're generating Bitcoin or mining Bitcoin. But on the flip side, you also have, because of all of this big push to get cryptocurrencies, the rise of the drive-bys, which is a combination of websites that if you go to a website, it's going to be using your CPU power within your browser to mine Bitcoin on a distributed basis.
Yes, I've heard about this.
And not all of it is because the site owner wants to do it. People are hacking sites so that they can inject their code to be able to
injecting mine. That code in ads.
Mm-hmm. Or targeting Android users.
Why Android users specifically?
Well, they're an easier target than iOS users.
Oh, I see.
But
putting an app on the App Store that's a really, really, really good flashlight that actually mines cryptocurrency for
exactly.
you.
Exactly. So seeing that side. And then just to top it all off, many universities, like, for example, Berkeley, mm-hmm. are going to be offering courses in cryptocurrency.
Okay.
So teaching how blockchains work and how the mining works.
Haven't they been doing that for a while?
Well, how long have cryptocurrencies really been popular?
I don't know.
The curriculum has only really started.
We've been talking about them for 10 years, dude.
Yeah, but how long has there been really money in it?
7 years.
So, yeah, you're talking about graduate-level courses at, you know, Carnegie Mellon, Cornell, Duke, MIT... And I'm still pessimistic about that.
What are you pessimistic about? The math?
I'm pessimistic about the notion that these are going to be a major part of the monetary flow of the world.
Why?
They, well, aside from the fact that they are ridiculously volatile right now.
Yes.
It is rapidly getting to the point where mining is more expensive than the currency is worth in the first place.
Like, well, you're talking about one currency. Like, I mean, you're talking about one process. The Bitcoin thing is the big beast, but that was the alpha of this whole process, right? It's not anywhere near the other systems that are occurring. For example, there's this Bitcoin called, I think it's called EOS, and it's built in the same type of technology as Ethereum. And when you buy into this, it's being doled out in small amounts, and at one point it'll become a terminal, like it won't have any more any more new coins being minted. And the amount that you own gives you processing time on a network, and it's very hard to explain, and I don't understand it well enough to explain, but the general idea is that you can buy into a distributed system that everybody participates at a small level, and the amount that you participate, I can't even do this justice. I need to have Michael on and talk about this stuff.
Given that, it still doesn't address, like, one of the reasons why people wanted to have cryptocurrencies was they were saying that it needed to be more free, not in the control of the Fed or
You know,
things like that. And at the same time, what did you end up with? Who are the people that are going to have access to the largest amount of these cryptocurrencies to begin with? And they're going to be people that have a fair amount of free time and disposable income. In other words, the people who already have money.
But you can also just think about it as digital cash in some ways too, right? You don't have to – if some of these stabilize, you have untrackable money.
Right, but only like if cash. You have that electronic infrastructure there. For example, Puerto Rico, disaster hits. Let's say you have millions of dollars in Bitcoin. There's no power. What do you do?
Yeah, but you could say the same thing about credit cards.
I could, but you can't say the same thing about dollars.
But you can. I mean, when disasters happen, money is volatile as well, just not as much.
Not as much volatile. But, I'm talking about you can't exchange with regard to a cryptocurrency.
Yeah, but you can't exchange. But you also can't if MasterCard is down, you can't use your credit card. I mean, these problems get solved because there's financial incentives for them not to exist, like the problems to be resolved. So it's not very – when it comes down to it, cryptocurrencies, when they get to scale and actually can do the same kind of things that credit card companies do, they will be the new technology for transactions online. Like it's just a matter of time before – I mean, the whole centralized system of a bank like MasterCard, of them controlling what occurs and getting a little bit of percentage the entire time, gets federated to anybody that participates on the network, gets a little bit of money over time, and the costs go down because the bank infrastructure, if you will, is not the same. It's distributed. Now, that last part, you could see that I did some hand waving there. I mean, obviously, Miles, you're obviously not a business person, because what you should be doing is, yes, cryptocurrency, blockchain, give me money. And then, because that's what you can do right now. You can be like, well, it's like Flickr, but with blockchain. And then, cha-ching, you roll in the dough.
I just think all the infrastructure with regard to FDIC insurance on the money that you have, you know, just doesn't exist. Yeah. People tout the lack of regulation with regard to cryptocurrencies, and there is a reason why a lot of this regulation exists.
Yeah, no, I totally get that.
Historically, I mean, a lot of people would say, like, there should be no regulation there. It's like, have you looked at the history, the reason why
We have safeguards
rules
because,
put in there.
Yeah, totally.
Like those reasons why the savings and loan side of a bank was kept separate from
What do you think? I mean, having the federal insurance process for banks definitely has a line of like protection. I get that.
Well, until Glass-Steagall was repealed, but that's a whole other story.
There is that piece of it, but we still are sitting on a house of cards. Like, there's nothing assuring, really, that everything will be stable. It's all about faith and systems, and cryptocurrency is a response. From my perspective, cryptocurrencies, thinking of banking in that form and transactions in that form, basically say, you know, this highly controlled bank infrastructure we've done, where large conglomerates are in control of what's happening, does not need to be the way that we do finance in the future. And it seems to me that just like it used to be you had to have a long distance carrier in your house and pay for that to call your grandmother in upstate New York, you don't have to do that anymore because we've changed the pattern. And I just think that this is an attempt at currency changes. I mean, put it this way. In 50 years, money will not work the same way as it works now. It's just a matter of time and how the process will work. I agree that it's not going to be an overnight thing. And it could be that cryptocurrencies do not win. But in 50 years, things will be very different than they are now. So don't you normally kind of assume that change will occur?
Things being different in 50 years is a very different proposition from, like, how we exchange money is different from, are we going to use money?
Cryptocurrencies are money. I mean, anything that you have a faith has value is money, right? Anything that's agreed upon value has money.
We're not talking about a barter system. We are talking about a currency. It's in the name. It's a
currency. What is currency except for specified barter? I mean, that's the same thing.
Well, it's one level above barter so that you don't have to trade like 5 chickens for a cow.
Right. But when it really comes down to it, anytime you make a generalized barter system, that's called currency. That they're the same thing. They're just structured differently, or we talk about them differently. What I'm talking about is not to do with whether we'll have currency or money or all that. Of course we will in 50 years, obviously. I mean, maybe 400 years we won't, but who the hell knows? Mm-hmm. But my point is that the current structure of having money in a world where you can have a really personal relationship with somebody in another country and actually give them value from that communication. But in the traditional form, you have to do a transaction through a bank where some of that money gets transferred into other somebody else participates in that, even though you and I know each other and we just happen to live in different parts of the world. Traditionally, you and I can just get together and I can give you money, you can give me money. But in a situation where the world is smaller and my best friend lives in Brazil and I live in the U.S., I can't give them money like that. That's not possible. But with cryptocurrency, it is possible.
Well, Western Union does work in Brazil, but that's all.
Yeah, but Western Union charges you.
That's true.
And they're involved in the transaction, and it's collected and conglomerated on who, you know, the information that you did that is not a private thing. So cryptocurrency solves those problems or changes how that works. To my mind, that in some ways the more interesting aspect of it.
I still feel it's conflating something. It's talking about being able to transfer monies without that transaction fee, which is
not necessarily without, there'll still be a transaction fee.
Well, I mean, without that conglomerate, mm-hmm. That is a very different thing from the cryptocurrencies themselves are a separate currency from dollars, yen,
yes, they are. Pesos. They are another currency. Absolutely agree.
And they are not backed by a particular government.
Mm-hmm. They're not geographically bound.
Mm-hmm.
They are internet. They're internet bound, and in fact, they're internet segment bound. If you split the internet right now, and you still worked on the blockchain, and then the Bitcoin mm-hmm. blockchain, and then you remerged the internet, and you had two different groups come together, the blockchain that was longer and valid would be the valid one, and the other ones would be invalid, and all currencies that were based off of that would be void, and that's part of the protocol right now, mm-hmm. and so it does have another side effect of the Bitcoin or any cryptocurrencies require absolute generalized knowledge to work, which is a weird way to think about it. Normally, you're like, I have a secret, and I'm the owner of the secret, and therefore I have the truth. But in the crypto world, you have to have everything public, or you can't rely on truth, which is a weird way of thinking about it. And it's unprovable. So at any time, all transactions over a period of time could be erased and null and void. Another blockchain come along that'd be longer. It's kind of a neat problem. Miles, I think it's your turn because I have no stories this week. It's only you, sir. We were talking about Bitcoin. I think we're gonna close that up, right? Or is there another piece you have?
Well, there's one last piece that I'd like to bring up. Another point brought up that I tend to see dramatic income inequality as being a major problem.
I agree.
And if you have, you know, well, what was it? 10 people who own have about as much wealth as
the rest of the world.
Half the world or something like that. The power inequality that inherent in that doesn't lend itself to a well-functioning society in the long term. It's been a hallmark of third world countries that you have a very wealthy few and everyone else has to scrounge away. And so there's no way to really move up or down in the social strata regardless of your inherent abilities.
Right.
You could be a genius and you end up, you know, start off with very little money. It's very hard for you to get out of that cycle of poverty.
And even if you do get out of that cycle of poverty, like, I mean, I think that it's possible for a few people that were, you know, raised with low income to succeed in some areas because of extreme luck. Like when you do hear those situations where they didn't have any money, grew up poor, blah, 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 and now they, you know, sold their startup for $1 billion, whatever. That is so infrequent as to be insignificant in the grand scheme.
Yeah, and they will also tell you stories about how they could have been like many of the people that they grew up with, including people that weren't necessarily dumber than they were or, you know, evil in some way. They were caught up with bad luck in a way that they were able to avoid. And also, you know, you have the flip side. You have people who really aren't that intelligent, but were born into money and born into privilege, and they can be elected president.
Yep. Why do you bring this up?
It was just, I bring it up because Bitcoin, you know, 1,000 users of Bitcoin have the vast majority of the wealth of it. And cryptocurrencies in general, there is a disparity there. And unless you're going to address income inequality, it's perpetuation of the same. Like, if you don't have to pay the conglomerates, like, as you say, like the Western Unions or the Visas or MasterCards, that is still taking away from the fact that there's still not going to be a level playing field
in order
to get that money flowing. The flow of money within an economy is what gets it going, not the accumulation and hoarding of it.
I think you and I are probably lean away from capitalism or more towards socialism or communism in some way. I'm going to label you as a communist right now. Pinky communist. Not really, because of course that's not a good way to communicate what I'm trying to say. So let me drop that. But my point is that long-running societies normally stratify people into class structures. We're doing it right now. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that cryptocurrency does not change that in any way.
Right.
I agree. I don't think that it inherently changes that at all.
I guess that's my annoyance with it is that I feel it's solving the wrong problem. And so, yes, you can make that one piece. It's kind of like the 80-20 rule in programming. This is saying that 80% of the time spent in a program is in 20% of the code. So you could be optimizing a whole bunch in this one area, but it doesn't actually affect the overall runtime of the code because where most of the stuff is running is in that 20%, and you have to really look for it. Mm-hmm. I feel that Bitcoin is outside of that 20%.
But it makes the system assuming that Bitcoin is trying to solve some justice system or there's some reason or rationale or beauty or inherent good about Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
I'm not claiming any of those things.
That was absolutely the reason for its being. People talking about how it enhances freedom, how it takes away the shackles of regulation. It was absolutely one of the core tenets for
I would agree that there was a lot. About. There's a lot of people in the Bitcoin space that feel that way about it. There's also a lot of interesting side effects of having systems that do a completely different way of sharing agreed upon truths, and to do that using a pattern that the blockchain concept, that whole idea, has produced another revolution of ways of thinking about data management and data sharing, data processing. So there is a piece of that that's about I've got my gold and everything's fine because I control it. You know, there definitely is that aspect, and I think that's you know, that's going to be true about any kind of technology. There's paper early on about, like, you know, I don't have to pay the postage anymore because I got email, right? But it doesn't mean that the entire thing is invalid because of that.
Well, see, here's the difference, though. If everyone that has email now, and usually that's older people.
Everybody has email.
Well, no, the younger generation generally doesn't like using
email. They have email. They have to for school. They don't use it.
So have email, use it. Then a new crop of people come into college, they have email. When I think of something like a cryptocurrency, the people that are in there right now that are mining or gathering, you know, hoarding, they're kind of done. And then people who are coming up, they're either going to have wealthy parents from cryptocurrency or they have nothing. I don't feel that that is sustainable.
Okay, just replace all the words you just said with cash. What's the difference? I mean, at some point, there's going to be stability in some cryptocurrency. We're going to use it as cash. It's just going to be the way things... Micropayments will be processed that way. You don't think that's true? Imagine a world in which a musician goes online. And yeah, instead of going to, you know, some place... What are the sites where you can... Indiegogo or FundMe or... What's the big one that's like that?
GoFundMe.
No.
Really?
Yeah. Okay. Those sites where you say, hey, I do something awesome, give me money.
Right. Yeah. totally blanking on
but
it, yeah.
It's the same thing as what we do for Patreon, right? It's the same kind of idea, right? People come together and give money. But of course, there's a company involved in that, and there's processing fees and a business around it, which is nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. But it also means that, you know, let's say you listen to 50 things in what you're enjoying and watching, right? So you're going to spend your $10 a month on Netflix for a whole bunch of that, and then you're going to spend... maybe a dollar to give to GeekSpeak because you like that show. But if you really spin that out, when it comes down to it, a dollar is actually too much because you're going to listen to too much media, right? You're going to engage in too much. So all the stuff that you actually participate in, it's hard to say, well, let's say my budget of entertainment is, I don't know, $80 a month. And I'm going to take some of those out because I like to go to the movie theaters and what's left over, and then I'm going to do my cable bill. And like pretty soon you whittle down to like, I've got $7 I want to spend and I listen to 50 different podcasts. Well, that's a problem, right? You can't really adequately do it. You've got to pick your favorites. But in a situation where the transaction fee is neutral or non-existent, which some of these cryptocurrencies process that way, you could just say, you know what? Here's the 70 things I like, and here's the $80 I have. Distribute it as I use it. That micropayment scenario is possible using cryptocurrencies.
Right, and I feel like we're talking about two different things. I feel like you're talking about something orthogonal to what I am. And with regard to
money, I'm talking about
like
the benefits of these
things. You made
a
very good point, which was about money, about saying that you could take away the cryptocurrency, replace it with the word money.
Yeah.
Except that we have a system in our country where, and most countries do, although, you know, it varies and there's some erosion of that, of paying taxes into a pool and having some of that money go towards services so that someone can have a startup. That is something that doesn't...
Meaning that if you go to 100% cryptocurrency for all things, all of a sudden our roads don't get repaired. We don't have an education system. Like, basically, you're talking about how do you tax a system of this nature?
Yeah.
Okay. So assuming that a government will probably figure out how to tax...
Because there's a lack of accountability with that. Yeah.
Assuming, though, that a government will figure out how to tax its populace, because if not, the government doesn't exist and the populace wants a government for all these things that we like, don't you think that will be resolved?
Here's the deal. When I think of right now, we have capital gains taxes. Now we're getting like out of geek speaking into like this is like marketplace or something. You have a capital gains tax.
I wish.
Yeah. That is lower than the nominal income tax, taxed at a different rate. And so you're not to mention that there are companies like they have the Dutch, Irish, forget what the other thing is, sandwich, you know, Cayman Island accounts and stuff like that, that you have these venues for the very wealthy to be able to avoid paying a taxes that someone with a more typical income, typical wages, would not be able to.
Sure.
And I see cryptocurrencies as being more of a tool for wealthy And so you end up with an eroding tax base that more heavily is skewed toward the brunt of people who have the least means to be able to.
I think earlier, you know, one of the things you said that was kind of telling to wait that you think about this, the stance on cryptocurrency, is you're saying it's like solving the wrong problem. Well, you're saying that there's better problems to solve, is what you're saying. Cryptocurrency is not solving the wrong problem. It's solving the problem it's solving. It's like, it's not, you can't give it some kind of meaning or methodology. It's just a technology, right? How it's used is dependent on the people that use it.
I would say that, except for the amount of attention and hype that it has.
Okay, so what you're saying is that the story behind it is painting this picture that's a lie about it because of all these things you're bringing up. Meaning like the narrative behind it is, oh, it gives you freedom away from the banks and you get to control your own finances in future and no one can charge you and you don't have to give money to conglomerates and all these wonderful things. And what you're saying is, yeah, but that's really not the problem you have. Or are you saying none of those things are true? Or are you saying actually there's so many other problems that are more important than that problem, it doesn't matter that that actually has that side effect? What are you saying?
The last one. That sounds a bit... That's about that. Right. That there are so many other problems that are so much more pervasive within society that if you solve this... It's kind of like you have, you know, a... Let's say a $2,000 rent. You're living in, you know, the Bay Area. And someone says, hey, I'm going to give you this $5 bill. Like... And I'm going to make it so that you can make that $5 bill, $5 into $7. And you go, but my rent is $2,000. Like, I need to do other things. Because if I spend time working on that $5 to $7, I'm going to be behind.
Okay, translate that meaning for cryptocurrency.
It's a distraction.
So you're saying that getting excited about cryptocurrency and getting to that market or doing the things that people are doing with cryptocurrency is all a distraction from the real problem, which is... People own things and other people don't and have to pay money for those things.
It's a distraction, and it's a distraction that emits a non-trivial amount of excess CO2, uses a non-trivial amount of electricity.
So my
and I understand there are other cryptocurrencies that don't do that.
No, first off, I totally agree with you. This idea of, hey, let's waste energy to make something that's virtual is really stupid. Obviously, that I do not like that. Like, Bitcoin should die just from the energy waste perspective. It should be shut off and not have any value at all. I don't even know if that problem still exists on every cryptocurrency or not. I haven't really gotten a final discussion about that. We also waste a lot of energy on lots of things, not at the level of Bitcoin. I'm not even claiming that. Mm-hmm. But there is energy waste. Like right now, we have more lights than we need. You and I are in a room at night in my home, and we have more lights on than we need because we're just having a conversation. We could do this in the dark. And why do we have that? Well, we enjoy light. Like that's
yes.
It's as simple as that, right?
But so you also have a whole bunch of LEDs, right?
Yeah, of course, as many as I can afford.
Right, so you're not using as much energy.
My point is that we waste energy all the time as human beings. It's part of what we do. And I totally grant you that Bitcoin is a totally another level of that problemscape. I give you that this idea that it's some kind of panacea of governmental control is ridiculous, kind of defeats the purpose of what it's for. And I agree that wasting your time on it too much makes no sense. It also brings up some other concepts that are pretty interesting. We live right now in this idea, this federated idea that our identity is managed by all these different brokers out there mm-hmm. that take money from us and own our identity in some ways, right? Mm-hmm. And that exists because you have to be assured the person you're dealing with is who you are, and we do that with passwords, and passwords aren't really viable for human minds. And all these things in some way tie together because this idea of really being able to control your data, which you have to do if you're involved in cryptocurrency, that concept is an important concept for us to understand. We have to move in to this next phase where we control our own identity and data and authentication of ourselves. And currently, there isn't systems for that. So I feel like it tackles other problems by side effect. I'm curious what you think, though, because you touched upon this, and there's bigger problems to fix. There's other problems that you alluded to. What are those other problems that you think are more important than whether MasterCard charges you a fee?
I mean, on the macro scale, I'm thinking of things like gerrymandering is a major issue. Lack of voting.
Yes.
Income inequality, I think, is a major issue. Yeah. The intrusion of large amounts of cash into our political system is a major problem.
I thought you touched on the cash in our political system earlier because it seems like such a you know, the way the majority is silenced right now is by lots of money pouring in and gerrymandering, which feed on each other, right? I mean, it's just the wrong way to run a government for, you know, making the most of the people excited and happy about their government. Do you see solutions to that?
In the technical sphere, no.
Why not?
I don't feel that the tech industry is well suited to solve that problem because I don't consider it a technical problem to begin with.
What kind of problem is it?
I believe it's a social problem. You don't need technology to convince people to, for example, make a constitutional amendment overturning Citizens United. That is not a technology. You can use technology to try to get the word out, but it is not a fundamentally a technological
problem
solution.
Yeah.
It's a you can use technology to help influence the social solution.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is some technology that can help in the sense that when you look at the current political maps for voting district maps that actually cause the side effect of gerrymandering, of making crazy maps. If you study those in a, try to be as neutral as possible about how to do those maps by some kind of simple algorithm, you could produce maps that were much more fair. So there are ways to, it used to be that you really did have to figure out where people are and someone walks the street and decides. But we have so much data now on where people live and how many people are in different areas that we really could come up with relatively neutral maps that could be dictated by agreed upon algorithm, if you will.
Right, but the drawing of the map, the technical side that figures out how to draw the map, is the easy part. We've already done that. The hard part is getting people to actually recognize them, to put them into effect. That's the social problem. That is the bottleneck. It doesn't matter how good a technical algorithm you make to make a fair district if it never actually gets put into place. And even the non-optimal...
So you're just taking about a grassroots movement to amass enough populace to say, we have to do it this way. I mean, that's the solution to that problem, right?
I was actually thinking we should just... If we can just get existing lawmakers to obey the law. I mean, Pennsylvania is a recent example.
Where the judge said this was not legal.
Panel of judges, a majority said that this is not legal. The Supreme Court went like, yeah, we're going to let that stand. And the legislators in that state immediately turned around and said, we're going to try to impeach the judges that voted.
You're kidding me. I didn't know that was the next step of that problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And said it very clearly. It was not like, oh, we're going to watch their machinations. They said straight up, we're going to try to get rid of these judges.
That is disgusting.
Pennsylvania is roughly 50-50 red-blue, Republican,
sure,
Democrat, by vote totals. There are 13 districts, congressional districts, in Pennsylvania. Three of them are Democratic. 10 of them are Republican.
Mm-hmm.
So even though the populace... It's about evenly divided by populace.
And this is about who wrote the maps of what the districts look like. That's all it's about.
Right. When the census came through and one party was in charge, they decided to draw the maps so as to best keep their party with a competitive advantage.
There's a great Gray article, YouTube video about gerrymandering that I will link to on this show. Fantastic about how gerrymandering actually works. Go on.
There have been court cases challenging this, saying this is unfair, this is undemocratic. And it has gone back and forth. Different states have gone through different trials and many cases. I think of North Carolina specifically, Arizona comes to mind, where the courts have said, yes, this is obviously unfair. And the Pennsylvania court case came back very specifically saying this is unconstitutional. It is violating First Amendment principles
and they tried to take it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, nope, the lower court, we're not going to hear the case. Well, that's what they actually said. They didn't say that other thing. We said, we won't hear the case.
Right.
And then the legislators decided to try to pull the judges from their seats.
Yes. Which, is of mixed effect because it's a Democratic governor, so that's who appoints the state Supreme Court justices. But at the same time, I think of what happened in 2016 after Justice Scalia died. And you had a vacancy on the Supreme Court for 11 months. And it was simply you block the appointment until run out the clock until the next administration comes in. And that's what happened. That's why there is no Supreme Court Justice Merrick. There is a Supreme Court Justice Gorsuch.
Right. Google Chrome is going to help protect us again by moving forward with kind of a drastic measure, I think.
Google Chrome is not alone. There are other manufacturers that are planning on doing this. But we've always been used to, you have HTTP, that's the default. And then if you do HTTPS, you get the little padlock.
Yeah, or green padlock. It's all nice and pretty.
Now it's flipping, especially with regard to initiatives like Let's Encrypt, so that anyone who wants a secure site can do so free of charge. You just have to do a little legwork. So now they're switching the default to be, there's no icon when it's HTTPS, but there is a label or an icon saying that it's insecure if it's HTTP.
So I have seen, I think for a while, when it's HTTP, you see kind of a broken icon. I got to get to one of my sites that I know doesn't do that. I guess, no, it's not a broken icon. It's got like a little circle around an eye.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's going to change from a little circle to an eye to a thing that says this is not secure.
Right. Probably something in red.
That's great. I mean, I think they talked about this a while ago. Clearly, it's a good thing to do. There are cases where doing SSL is actually a little challenging. And that's only because the systems in place make it difficult. Examples of this are subdomains on a main domain. Or, for example, the pictures that I host are up at this company called SmugMug, and I pay them money for hosting my site. And one of the things you want to do when you promote URLs is you want to own the URL you promote. So the URL that I give them or that I redirect my traffic to that they actually host 100% is one of my domains. So anytime I want, I could scrape their entire site, which is actually all my pictures, and then put up my own copy locally. Mm-hmm. And manage it myself. If I were to do that, it would be very easy for me to make an SSL certificate for it. But for them to make an SSL certificate, they have to have control over my root domain, which I don't want them to do. So it's a challenging thing for that kind of process. Another example of that is Tumblr, right? Where I have my blog at Tumblr, and it is my domain, but they can't make an SSL cert. They shouldn't be able to make an SSL cert for that. Or maybe they could.
Well, they can
for the subdomain.
If they do a wildcard for a subdomain, and usually if they have a...
No, the issue is that the domain itself is actually my domain, right? So it's microblog.lyle.troxel.com, right? But I think actually they could do an SSL on just that subdomain.
You can. That is an area that, like, you wouldn't be able to support IE8, for example.
Right, right.
But you can actually host virtual domains, so the same IP, and have it figure out which host you're going to before it determines which cert to send to you.
And clearly there's a pattern there's a way to solve this problem, right? I mean, there's other ways of doing the same solution. And the truth be, blocking HTTP would be a problem for me. I would have problems with that. Saying, hey, this is not secure, make sure you know this the entire time, is a perfect way of doing that. Browsing through my pictures or reading my public blog non-secure, that's okay. But if a form field goes in and someone's going to type something, they should be kind of conscious of that problem.
Right. And more to the point, there's a lot of technology that is now completely dependent upon HTTPS. Or
like what?
A secure connection. HTTP 2 assumes a secure connection.
I did not know that.
Service workers, which are background processes trying to make webs more app-like, you need to have a TLS tunnel on there, or you have a major security vulnerability.
We have a major security vulnerability, but it doesn't mean it doesn't work.
No, it's not so much about the fact that it's encrypted. It's the fact that a certificate allows you to authenticate who you're talking to.
No,
if you have
this
background process that is working without you seeing, and it can connect to whatever without your interaction. That's a major security vulnerability.
The move to HTTPS has been pushed by iOS makers as well. Apple has this whole mandate for all apps to go HTTPS, and they talked about it a year and a half ago, and they said eventually it'll be mandatory. You must do this, move that direction. And there's a lot of apps in general right now, even though you have to log in and maybe do second factor authentication, theoretically the app itself wouldn't necessarily need to phone home through HTTPS. Hopefully the people that are being responsible do that, but Apple is going to turn off HTTP for apps at some point so that they're forcing to do that. When you say, though, that HTTP 2 requires SSL certificate, is that true that HTTP 2 will not be working on non-SSL tunnels?
The spec does not mandate it. Okay. However, the implementation within browsers only works over a secure channel.
So Chrome has implemented it such that it will not work.
Yep.
That's kind of cool. It makes dev a little bit more challenging when you're doing development work.
The thing is, with regard to HTTP, I mean, I have a soft spot for it because I could see what was on the wire. It's a very simple protocol, text-based, and you know, or at least I knew exactly what was going on. When you get into the realm of HTTP 2, which is a binary multiplexing strategy. Yeah. So a single socket contains multiple streams of resources, unlike with HTTP where it's one at a time or multiple sockets at once.
That multiplex is happening on the main, on the one port, if you will. So the complexity of trying to parse it as a human doesn't really work, right?
Right. You would need to have some tool that, and usually that's your web browser.
Sure.
The dev tools have become so much better that it offsets a lot of that. I guess HTTP, I have that bit of nostalgia for because, or HTTP 1.1 and below, because it is pretty much the last protocol of the popular protocols that was like that.
Mm-hmm.
I have to rephrase that. It is not the last. It is a sign of the future because you have protocols like SMTP, which is how you send mail. Yep. You have IMAP4, how you receiving mail. These are all text-based. They're all, you put a line of...
Meaning that, like, you could emulate the communication by typing.
Yes.
It's not that hard. It's like, hello, and then get, resource, whatever.
Yeah.
Pretty...
Mail from RCPT2, data.
We know you're very impressive. So, but that's a more simplistic way of communicating, and newer protocols are more complex and just don't allow a human to intersect them.
For SMTP, it hasn't been a big deal. You're sending a mail, sending some email. It's really only one socket, and many web servers will batch the
technically
items together.
The very early mail clients that handle SMTP can still use the same protocol.
Yes,
which is
in theory
insecure and nasty.
Well, no, you can do SMTP over SSL over TLS.
I feel like we verged off this topic point a bit, but what you're saying is you're kind of okay with HTTP2, which has this multiplexing communication protocol on top of HTTP, being tunneled through SSL, and you brought up that you used to be able to speak it, but now you can't. Why does it matter? How do those connect?
If I have something that, if I'm open up Wireshark, for example, and I...
This is a sniffing thing.
Yeah, network sniffer. And I provide it the private key to a cert. Mm-hmm. Then it can decrypt the communication that's going back and forth, so it looks like a standard chain, and I can see what's going on as though it were text. It is also possible to tunnel through a secure channel and emulate.
Provide a cert for it. Wireshark, so you can actually sniff it.
Right. Well, I mean, you can hack it so that it's almost like Telnet, almost like SSH, but going to a site.
You know, I was updating the website recently, geekspeak.org, because I have been, every time that GitHub says, hey, you have a vulnerable package in your 7-year-old application, I go, ah, and I jump on that because I think it's like one thing I can do to be responsible. And so I go and I update it by pushing new patches. Last time I did that, right before the show from last week, I totally blew away the ability to upload an MP3 file, which delayed our MP3 from last week quite a bit, I must say, or the week before. But in any case, when I was doing that, I also went ahead and updated our patron list, the people that have donated money to us. And I just want to say that when I've recorded the thank you to the people that give us money every month, I've said so in a very, I read it through, I make it part of a radio thing. I put on my radio hat. I make it about, like, make this interesting to the entire audience, but also thank the people. But I really just want to say, the people that, the 24 people or 25 people that are actually donating money every month to make the show work for us financially and to help spread the word, thank you so much for doing that. That is a, I look at that that commitment from you, and I you know, justify my own investment and interest in the show. And I know I've been doing it. I mean, I think it's only been a couple years that we've been doing Patreon and get any kind of revenue from the show. I've been doing the show for like almost 18 years with Miles as a volunteer and never, you know, receiving anything. And all the money, that, of course, that we receive from this goes right back into the show. I don't like pocket anything. We buy equipment for the show. We buy bandwidth. We buy ads. But just having that kind of commitment from you all is really touching. Thank you so much for doing that. You know, it used to be that Miles and I would beg and ask for people to donate money to KUSP. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I still believe in local radio, obviously. It's important for a community to be tied together by some form of communication that's geographically bound, hence local radio, hence my extra time and effort to commit to making this show work for KBCZ in Boulder Creek. But doing this when I know there's people there giving money directly to me and Miles doing this show, thank you very, very much for doing that. I really appreciate it. If you haven't done this, if you haven't given us money through Patreon, please feel free to do so. You can learn about Geeks at geekspeak.org/support. But also, you know, if you just want to support us another way, just write us a review on iTunes and tell people you like the show and tell somebody that you think might be interested. Share the link with them. The more people we get listening, the more people get to enjoy it and the better interviews we get as well. We covered a whole bunch of cryptocurrency stuff, but you had cryptocurrencies come to campus. What was that about?
That was that universities are teaching the topic.
I see. Okay, yeah. So we did already cover that. Yes. I feel like that's a strange one to have a problem with.
I don't necessarily have a problem with it. I just find it humorous, especially because in later years with college, I heard people talk about the jobs that you have, there isn't a college course for. Like what you're learning now...
You know, it's always the case, sure.
Always emerging. And I guess there's a feeling of me, for me, that folks are taking these courses for cryptocurrency, and by the time they're out of college and can put them into action, I feel like the landscape will have changed so much that it will not be relevant anymore.
It's almost already irrelevant in some regards. If you weren't in the game early, it's not some place you can make a whole bunch of money. I think that's the other thing about cryptocurrency, that there are people that are really excited about it for the day trading aspect of it. And there's a lot of money and time and energy invested in that. Mm-hmm. And that highlights this idea like, oh my gosh, this person was a millionaire because of blah, 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 right? Those things are interesting from a we like interesting stories aspect. Mm-hmm. But what the blockchain concept can do and how we can think about sharing data differently is interesting as well. And that's not connected directly to the people that are doing day trading. It's an interesting technology. Do you think that's true, or are you like, meh?
No, I do.
Okay.
You know, massively distributed databases that have eventual consistency, is an interesting problem.
I don't know. The other day my mother said to me, Lyle, I tried listening to your show recently. You know, posted on Facebook, she saw it, and she turned it on for a minute, and she's like, I can't understand what you guys are saying. And this is the first time that somebody said to me, I couldn't understand what you said, what were you talking about, but I really liked listening to you guys. She didn't say that part. She just said I couldn't understand it. So I feel kind of bad about that. Now I'm like, I don't know. I mean, personally...
She has been listening for almost 17 and a half years now.
I don't think any of my, you know, close family listen to this regularly. But I guess my point is that it's always been challenging to figure out that middle ground of when we can get all geeky and stuff. This discussion we're getting into now, obviously, is a much more technical discussion. You and I can follow it, and it's fun mm-hmm. for us, and I'm sure there's a large percentage of our audience base that likes it, but some people will be turned off by it.
Here's the crux of the matter. When you and I both began developing
back,
for the web.
Way back in the day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right back in 95, 96. You learned web pages by going to view source. So that's how you did web development. You learned by looking at other people's websites. And I learned about how HTTP works by like seeing some articles about it and, you know, typing into Telnet to port 80 and going like, oh, wow, it really is just text coming in there. Then you put the URL in, you put, you know, what the host name is, and you're done.
I remember like taking that mental mind, like I wanted to collect information from a user. And I knew that I could run Perl CGI, and I needed to make a web page. And I was trying to figure out the difference of like how a web page was loaded versus CGI, and I was really confused, and then finally it like hit me. I just have to have the application I'm writing print out the text that looks like HTML,
right,
and it will work. And it was like a very edifying experience. Completely self-taught, obviously.
Right, but it's also, it's accessible.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is once you get past that initial hump of that anxiety,
yeah,
you find out that it's actually simpler than you imagined it to be.
So what you're saying is this new pattern of multiplexing sockets over one connection goes above a level of accessibility.
We are but at the point now that someone goes view source on a typical website, you have no idea what's going on. There's no way to...
It's been like that for a while.
It has been, and it's... I'm bringing this up as this is the change, and there are good reasons for those changes. HTTP2 adds in a lot of efficiencies, especially if you are on like Google scale. If you're a mom and pop shop, it's I don't know how important it is. It's I guess it's just that hearkening to a simpler, more innocent time.
Yeah, where there wasn't giant security vulnerabilities. We
weren't aware of them yet.
Well, yeah. I mean, it didn't matter as much, right? You were visiting websites and not even doing buying. You know, if you were doing purchasing, it might have been through eBay. I don't know. It felt like a simpler time.
Didn't do much in the way of scripting. Now JavaScript is everywhere for even the most basic pages.
I mean, that is true. There is a boundary that's different. But, of course, your comment about being accessible presupposed your ability to telnet. Most people don't know how to do that. So when the web came along, actually viewing source to see how structured it was and being able to edit via, what was the tool before DevTools? There was like a plugin.
Oh, Firebug.
Firebug, yes. Firebug gave you that kind of capability of live editing a web page and seeing what happened and changed it. Very cool. But the tool, as long as the tools maintain some semblance of accessibility, you will keep getting the kind of being able to inspect and invest at the same time. For example, React is a very common framework at this point. Have you started using React yet?
I haven't.
Okay. So there is a Chrome DevTool plugin for React, which detects React and actually, especially if you have source maps, actually give you a full debugging tool in browser. And a site that uses React, if you load this Chrome Dev tool, and then on the side you'll see all this stuff about how the site is actually running, how the refresh cycle works, the store, all that stuff about React works. So it becomes that you need tools. But then again, you need a tool too. You need a telnet terminal to see how it should be.
But that was the difference. I didn't need to do any extra installation. You could have a reference that told someone who was on, at the time I was mostly Windows, to say, okay, now go to this menu, open up command prompt, and then type this exactly as you see it.
Right.
And it would work.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's no barrier to entry. There's no, I have to download this extra tool.
And right now, if you tried to do that with, like, google.com, you would get one response, and that response would be a redirect to HTTPS, and then you can't telnet. That's done.
Right.
Even if you got, I don't know, to get a redirect, actually, you might just get a non-response.
No, you get a redirect.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you've been listening to GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. This is GeekSpeak, a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. Today's show, titled by Greg Merkley in Canada, John Barlow Secures Verizon's Bitcoins, included a theme song by Michael Newman of Pretstar Music, myself, Lyle Troxell, and Miles Elam. Thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
Can you just do the title?
We also look into Google Chrome's move to label unsecure sites, Verizon's trouble with phone thefts, and speak in depth on cryptocurrencies. All this and more on this week's episode of GeekSpeak.
I wouldn't say in depth. I would say we talk about it from our...
It's what's written there.
No, it's fine. I just feel like that we, like at some point, I had to totally bunt on how you actually do shared processing in the blockchain.
Yeah, that was a lot more just like straight up politics and not. But then again, we were talking about how the technology doesn't fix it.
The technology doesn't fix it.
I think that is an important part about technology. Is
it don't fix stuff?
Recognizing when it is not the solution to a problem. Like, I mean, we're all guilty.
I don't think it's ever really a solution to a problem, is it?
Sure it is. It depends on what the problem sets are.
I guess as a programmer, I don't think of software as solutions to... I don't think of technology as a solution to good problems. Like, interesting problems aren't... inherently, an interesting problem that has a technical solution isn't interesting to me anymore.
How to allow people to watch movies from their home. That's a problem. And it's one that Netflix and among others have addressed.
Only Netflix. So, I guess that's a problem. Is that the problem?
Entertainment.
I don't think entertainment's a problem, really. I mean, you think about like what you actually want from entertainment, and you think about that as a core value and a problem space that we possibly have. First off, we don't have an entertainment problem. We don't have a lack of entertainment problem at all. So I don't think of that as really. But if you want to say, well, I want to be able to connect to any kind of content around the world, because, you know, then it starts becoming more of like an interesting problem. Like, I don't know enough about Mexico and I want to see more movies from Mexico. Then it's like, oh, what's the solution to that problem?
I do have to say, though, that I honestly do believe that the advent of streaming services like Netflix has improved the quality of programming.
Okay. And I would say that the long tail has become wonderful on YouTube. The ability to find and research something that you mm-hmm. want to learn about is amazing. And you were talking about earlier, I meant to kind of bring up this, you were talking about earlier about HTTP, and like now that's secure and now there's HTTP2 has multicasting, socket sharing kind of crap.
Yeah.
What do you call it? Whatever, we don't need to get into that again. That you then need technology to solve it and stuff. At the same time,
Multiplexing.
Thank you. I knew I had it wrong. At the same time, that the ability to learn those things has become easier and easier. I can, like, from my home right now with my measly internet connection, I can learn exactly how that protocol works, and I can learn exactly how gerrymandering works with these great videos from CGP Grey. Like, there is knowledge at my fingertips on demand because of these technologies that make that barrier to entry much less than it used to be. Like, if you wanted to learn how to be a blacksmith 10 years ago, you got to go to a bookstore and find a book. You got to go to a library, find a book. You got to go find a magazine. Then you got to find some kind of group that gets together. Maybe there is a magazine. In fact, I'm a member of the Blacksmiths Association of California. And then you get their mailing, and then they have events every few months you can go to, and you travel to that event, and then you meet somebody that hopefully lives near you, and then you say, hey, can I learn from you? Like, this is a giant process. Mm-hmm. Or you can just like click a couple buttons and learn how to do it. It's amazing.
Yeah,
I derailed your discussion though.
That's totally fine. Like I said, the beginning of it was like recognizing when things aren't a problem, and we do it all the time. Every programmer has. You have some particular problem, and you over-engineer the hell out of it.
Sure.
Where you're not solving the problem anymore, you're satisfying a personal itch.
Electronic voting is exactly that yes. space, right? Yes. Oh, we can do this with computers because computers have data, and this is a data problem. No, it's not. Yeah. It's a truth problem.
Right. But then you'd be able to, you know, cast a ballot from HTTPS. Like, why we can't do that from our homes? Well, there are other issues involved there.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just about that access there.
See, I want everybody to use particle board for voting. I'm sorry, paper for voting.
Particle board. So after you're done with the ballot, you just put a little water in there and the whole thing disintegrates.
I am disheartened, though, by, speaking of ballots, I'm disheartened by how little I believe our current system empowers voters. It's really depressing to me in the sense that, you know, can I really tell my 16-year-old who will be, you know, voting in a couple of years, yeah, you definitely should vote. That's really important. In California? Really? Is it?
Like, yes. Absolutely it is.
But you get my stance. Like, I believe that my vote, I've always been a strong believer in voting. I've always been a strong believer in, you know, the public making a stance and deciding what's going on. But when you look at how the power structure works, voting is really depowered at this point. Gerrymandering destroys that at some level.
You're talking about national elections.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. Yes, I was talking about national
elections. Best elections are local ones.
True.
That's where people have the most power, and that's where they should be exercising the most power, and that's where the least amount of attention is. So, yes, I think more people should vote, and I think that it absolutely does make a difference with regard to gerrymandering on a large scale. Yeah, that's a problem. It's a major problem.
Can't states do gerrymandering too? Does that happen as much? I mean, for state politics and local politics?
Yes, absolutely. They do it in all the countries that are – or all the states that are doing it for federal elections as well.
Why was gerrymandering not handled better in our constitutional structure? Was it because it didn't that problem didn't exist the same way because of lands in regions in England being lord-based? Like
it's a very different when the country was founded, there was no one person, one vote.
Right. It was
There was no one man, one vote, and you know, women couldn't vote, but it was you were
a landowner.
Yeah.
And so basically you own land, you voted.
You were a white landowner, yeah.
But basically the amount of acreage you had determined the worth of your vote? Is that how it worked?
No, but you were the way things worked out was you had a lot of people that were, you know, either in your employ or the like. You cast your vote, you still had to, in some respects, you know, answer to the folks that you were representing. You were an elector.
Right.
That's where the Electoral College came from, was, you know, like you had these proxy votes go in there.
So it was basically just to make the system effectively work better. If you had a few landowners in a certain area, even if there was tenants and all that, they kind of voted in benefit of the people that were there. The idea was that?
Remember that there weren't cars. The fastest speed of everyone was a horse, and you didn't have...
effectively walking distance, or walking speed, a little faster.
And so the polling areas, you know, would be many, many miles away. You wanted to have a horse. Not everyone could get there.
Yeah. No, I guess what I'm saying is that...
So the logistics of it were different.
We have an impressive system of government here. The checks and balances that exist is impressive. And this idea that the law has to change over time and there has to be a way to do that effectively and checks and balances even against that, these are really interesting and what I believe really important processes. We have major success in that regard. Gerrymandering right now is kind of wrecking a lot of that. And I'm just curious why it wasn't thought through better when we had early thoughts around how our government would be run. I'm assuming because... it just wasn't thought as a problem because of the structures that existed at the time.
Yeah, I mean, gerrymandering also puts, you know, a lot of power with the people who are already powerful. Mm-hmm. That's how voting was done then. The people who voted were the people who had power. So, yeah.
So it always kind of existed.
Yeah. That and, you know, suppressing the minority vote.
Can we talk about something fun for a second?
Sure.
Tell me something you're doing that's interesting with software. Oh, I saw your pull request. There's more comments about the Node pull request.
That's been going on for a while. Like
you had to pull your HTTP reference. They're going to do it on a different pull request. Not that you'll do that necessarily.
HTTP 2, yeah.
What other changes happened?
Well, see, that's the thing, though, is I did that to scratch an itch, which was I wanted to be able to have a client be able to make an HTTP call where the response came back of a certain informational type. Making this pull request for the Node project is interesting in that in order to get my code in, I had to write a test. But I couldn't write a test unless there was a way to generate the extra informational message, a status code coming through, the 102. The server didn't support that.
Wait, the test server is Node?
Yes. So I had to write that functionality into the server to generate a 102 in order to have the client be able to process a 102 correctly, which was out of scope of what I wanted to do. But it was like,
okay. You have to make the same pull request be both sides of that and also have – okay.
Because you needed to have a test. And how do you have a test? Because you have to generate that content. You generate the content with Node.
That's fantastic.
So,
hey, can
I got
I, can
that.
I, can
so I get
ask...
that done. Wait, hold on. Yeah. So I get that done, and then it becomes wait, you did that for the HTTP portion for the server, but there's also the HTTP 2 portion of the server, and now I'm like, oh, man.
I like that you pulled that out. So do you think you're close?
Well, yeah, I think it's done, at least for this portion. But now I feel like I'm on the hook for making the follow-up pull request
Don't
to do the HTTP/2.
But can I ask, like, if I will you do an interview on NodeUp about this? I think it'd be really interesting.
Do an interview where?
So Rod Vag and a couple other people in the Node community run this podcast called NodeUp. It's kind of the de facto. It's the first podcast about Node. It's kind of the de facto. Oh. People that, you know, all the people that started Node and worked on Node have been on the show. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the show talking about the conference I used to do, a Node conference I used to do. I ran like the sessions for the kids. And mm-hmm. Any case, it's a pretty interesting podcast all about Node. And I think it'd be a really interesting track to say, no experience with Node, a year ago, lots of experience with JavaScript. Had to work, just talking about this problem space in a relatively generic way. You want to talk about the actual project, the work project. But I think it'd be really interesting to have that process.
Actually get into, but yeah, just talking about the Node portion of it. And
yeah,
being like
how the pull request, what was it felt like to be in the community, all that crap. That'd be really interesting. I'd like to interview about it, but I think it'd be neat to have it in a bigger audience of Node people, because I think our audience would get a little bored by that topic, sir. All right, I'll introduce you to Rod. I think Rod's still doing it. Do we still have Pat with us?
Yeah, I think I got my mic.
You did. I can hear you.
So what did you think about our foray into politics?
Yeah, I thought I was expecting to hear something about the launch. Guys.
We talked about the launch before the launch. It's true. We didn't cover the launch. That's pretty lame.
I thought it was.
Oh, man, the landing of those was so incredible.
Yeah, yeah, the side-by-side landing was incredible. They lost one, but it was like 2 out of 3. Not too bad.
My favorite thing about that whole experience was telling Maggie what had happened. I'm like, so can I show you a picture from space? And she's like, okay. And then I show her. And she's like, what? I was like, that's a Tesla orbiting the planet. And she's like, and she got all giddy, like, you know, I don't, if there was just this, there's this quality of just like awe about it.
Right. But see, we ask for flying cars. This is the problem with lack of specificity.
That's good.
All the memes that are going around now, too, with, you know, the CHP officer giving him a ticket for speeding and stuff.
Yeah. The other one is that really a dummy? Or did Elon Musk pull off the greatest murder in the history of the world?
Okay, so
like in 100 years, will we catch up to it and becomes this like historical thing? And they check it out and they go like, wait a second, that's an actual body.
It's true. It'll be years before anybody sees it, if ever. I didn't follow up on. There was some discussion that the Tesla would be pushed in, would just orbit Earth, and there was some discussion that it's going to orbit Mars at some point.
No, it's beyond Mars. It's going to the asteroid belt.
It's off.
They call that a Mars orbit, but it's not orbiting Mars. It's a Mars orbit. It's a heliocentric orbit in about the orbit of Mars. It's a little, almost not deceptive, but inaccurate calling it a Mars orbit.
No, but they overshot, though.
A solar orbit that has it reach what could be an insertion point to Mars.
Right.
But obviously they're not going to retro burn and slow it down for a landing.
No, but what I mean, though, is that they overshot Mars orbit. They actually overshot it by like 30%.
They overshot.
Yeah. Yeah.
They overshot.
They ran it a bit too long.
Well, it's not there yet, but it will overshoot.
Yeah, it's asteroid belt.
So the shots that it just has Earth in the background was just as it was leaving orbit.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that was in Earth orbit when it was doing that.
Right, right.
That was before the second burn, or the third burn.
Okay, so there was multiple stage burns. So they got it to a low Earth orbit, and then they continued with other firings.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were, 16 hours between second and third burn, something like that?
Yeah. And I guess that's why the stream stopped. I was surprised. All of a sudden, stream's done. You know, they're all panicking about the center core, and then the stream went off. And I was watching on CBS News on another tab, and that stream turned off and talking, you know, about, you know, Trump something, something, something. It's like, what the hell happened here? And everything was about the center core, and the announcers panicked. I don't know.
But was there a problem with center core, or did they just turn off the feed?
Yeah, center core. Core crashed. The engines, it was a suicide burn and reentry. and center core two of the engines didn't reignite. So it crashed about 300 feet away from the drone ship, and the impact of the explosion, well, I wouldn't say explosion, the impact blew out the thrusters on the drone ship. I'm sure it's, if we ever get to see the video of that, it's going to be spectacular. I don't know if we will, though.
Oh, so I see. They might not have the footage of it because the ship that was recording it died.
Yeah, I think there were other vessels recording. I'm not really sure about that, though.
They didn't actually sink the barge, though, did they?
No, it didn't sink. Yeah. No, it was heavily damaged, but
damaged it.
And yeah, it didn't sink.
Yeah. Yeah. So, in other words, that third booster landed like every other rocket in the history of rocket flight.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Oh well. You know, it was a good attempt. And the other two, the parallel landings, oh my God, that was incredible.
Exactly. The flight of the parallel landings, like when they first ejected from the main whatever and they were being piloted, it was all synchronous. It was this amazing thing. Like, yeah, really incredible. Yeah.
Like a half a second of each other touching down.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Intentionally a half a second so the radar reflections wouldn't interfere with one another.
Right.
Yeah.
Wait. They intentionally delayed one by half a second so they could know when they both touched, when they could deal with the difference of their location?
Yeah.
Yeah, so the radar from the one wouldn't affect the other on its final touch.
Amazing.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, man. I mean, everything about that is intense. I mean, the software development behind doing something like that is it's a feat in itself. You know, the engineering all around. I don't know, it's like, you know, humankind's greatest achievement so far. I don't know. That's what I would say. Pretty cool.